Welcome to Foot Fairy, the godmother of all athletic shoe stores. How may I help you? So, you're showing me what? Those are those little emoji things from your phone?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so little yellow running guy. And then, is that a yellow face with the teeth clenched?
Mm-hmm.
Is that guy a Russian Cossack, or is he one of those English beef eaters? Because the hat could go either way.
He, foot guard, need running shoe, not hurt.
Now you're showing me a bundle of cash, and a little microphone, and a sad yellow face. I don't get it.
Work public radio. No have much money.
What's wrong with you anyway?
Use emoji too much. Forget how use letter things.
Words?
What you said.
But wouldn't it be better to try to use words so that you recover that ability? Let me see. The yellow face sticking its tongue out at me. I get it.
I use words. You big monkey head with social disease.
Okay, maybe go back to the emoji.
Today on show, language turn into just pictures? Also, speak of pictures, people take selfies in wrong places. Also, man get $46,000 to make one bowl potato salad. And now, emoji for him. Pile of poop, fire, doorbell, runaway, Colin McEnroe.
That does tell pretty much the story of a good chunk of my life anyway, all in emoji. So you're welcome to our very emoji-based show today, although what it really is one of our panelists today, the writer Rand Cooper, spent 2 weeks up in Vermont with no internet and little or no cell phone connectivity. And so we've decided to besiege him today with all the abominations of the digital age. So we're going to talk about emoji, we're going to talk about selfies, and we're going to talk about Kickstarter. So that'll do it. I think that'll be a pretty good trifecta. Also with us, Rebecca Castellani, a scholar of modern language, soon to depart for Scotland, where she will become a rebel in their independence movement. And then joining us from The Cut, Teresa Kramer, of ordinarily a very attractive young woman, but today there's something wrong with her. She has like a zombie thing going on with her face. But we love her anyway. I mean,
but keep your distance.
Seriously, though, as you're listening, picture somebody with really something very wrong with them. Don't want her to hear me say this.
All right. So, okay, clearly the first question is not going to Teresa. So we're talking about emoji. Now, for people who don't know what emoji are, well, Miss Modern Language Scholar, do you want to explain what emoji are? Or do you want me to do it?
Sure, I'll do it.
Okay.
So they're little smiley faces and little people and sometimes little smiling turds that you can send in lieu of words to express your feelings via text message.
Yeah, so it's this kind of pictorial language system that people drop into texts and tweets and Facebook posts and stuff like that. And I think it started, correct me if you think I'm wrong, I think it started initially just with those little yellow, you know, ball-shaped faces. And it was meant to just – the name obviously implies what the original plan was. In case you're wondering whether I'm being sarcastic or whether I'm sad or whether I'm happy, here's something to tell you.
Yeah, I mean emotional qualifiers, because so much of that is lost in text speak. I think they started off with just the basic colon dash parentheses, which I'm still using. I feel like I'm betraying my generation by saying this. But until yesterday, I didn't even have the Apple emojis. But now they've turned into this whole, you know, dictionary of combinations you can use to describe any array of silly feelings.
Yeah, it is a pictorial language. But, you know, unfortunately, Rand, I'm still giving Teresa a full amount of time. She actually just has poison ivy, so don't worry. But it's like on her face. Rand, you know, interestingly, since that was its original purpose, in the New Republic article that we read, very interesting New Republic article, the author begins by describing an exchange between her and a friend. The friend's moving away. They have a final text exchange where she sends a sad, weepy face or something, and the friend sends an emoji of a little chick with its wings slash arms outstretched. And then the author says something like, "Were we being serious or ironic? Even now, I'm not sure." So if they existed initially to clarify people's emotions, I'm not sure they're still doing that. You're just going to sit there and look unhappy about this.
Since I'm here essentially to be reactionary, I probably need more to react to. But let me just say one thing that's fairly innocuous.
Yeah.
I think we've all fallen afoul of the tonal ambiguities and uncertainties of emails, for instance. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting thing about email. I know now email is a thing of the past. That's part of the big problem that we'll get to later. But often it's been the case that I send an email and a misunderstanding ensues that has to do with the fact that the tone, mm-hmm. Either of my email or the other person's email, was misheard. Mm-hmm. And so if these emojis, a nice word actually, are intended to help clarify that, they're made necessary because those tonal problems are a product of an already abbreviated and attenuated form of communication. In letters, in those ancient days, you tended not to have these kinds of tonal misunderstandings because you were building a richly tonal context of communication throughout many sentences. When you get down to two or three half sentences, whoops, someone thought I was mad, but I was just being brief. And so the need to use happy faces, frowny faces, little chickens, daisies, rainbows going into clouds, and other lovely pictographs in order to flesh our meanings out fully is, in my view, a sometimes amusing but mostly tragic consequence of the steady attenuation of our forms of communication, which will be my topic today.
All right. Do you find them tragic, Teresa Grammer?
I don't know that I find the original emojis tragic because I think, like Rebecca, I think I still stick to the basic smiley face. And I think I mostly use them if I'm making some sort of joke or sarcastic remark that someone might think I was actually making, you know, calling them hideous or something, you know, like they might do to me today. I will put a smiley face or something after it. Just
or you could
know.
Be calling them hideous and then put the smiley face to just sort of like, soften okay. the blow a little
yeah.
bit.
But when we started talking about this and I started exploring the entire world of emojis, I was sort of wondering what anyone could possibly use most of these for, like the camel or the smiling turd, which I actually love and I will probably actually start using now because it's just funny.
What utterance? I haven't seen the smiling turd.
Yeah.
But, you know, if the theme is turds, not
we
words.
We really want to say smiling turd as many times as possible on the show today.
So it's turds, not words. So what ideas does the smiling – or what relationships or situations does the smiling turd smooth over?
I don't feel as though the smiling turd has any real use in communication other than to send it to someone just to make them laugh.
If you just got
a text and all that was there was a smiling turd, you would laugh, yeah. right? Someone's day would be brightened.
I'm laughing at the yeah. word.
Didn't you say you've used this particular icon?
No, I said it's the only one that makes me laugh.
It's the only one that you,
yeah.
okay. Our number, please don't call about the ST, but 860-275-7266 if you want to converse a little bit about this, and you can do so without using emojis. 860-275-7266. John is tweeting to us the origin of emoji goes back as far back as 1996 in pagers in Japan. They originally were an effort to avoid direct communication. Of course, there's the emoji, which is a produced item, right? Mm-hmm. This is like, you know, you've seen them. I'm assuming most people have seen them. Whereas the emoticon was the thing
right.
that preceded it was where people were just using punctuation to make facial expressions, which brings us to the man. There's been a lot of research or some research into all this. In answer to the question, what can emojis be used to do? There is somebody whose name is Fred Benenson, who has set out to translate every line of Moby Dick into Emoji Dick. And has not only set out to do it, he did it.
Emoji Dick.
Emoji Dick is what he calls it. He got $3,500 on Kickstarter, another topic for later in the day. He had people – he found strangers who were through something called Mechanical Turk – Turk, that is, who are willing to help him with this. And so he now has, in fact, done a finished product that he's calling Emoji Dick. $200 for hardcover if you want to try to buy it online. You can just get a PDF for $5. But I forget what I was about to say before I got distracted into all of this. But I know what it was. The going back to the emoticons, now those are the ones that are just made with little bits of punctuation. Teresa, there was one researcher we found who had studied the difference between people who, when they made a face in this manner, I'm hoping to describe this as vividly and graphically as I can, when they made a face using an emoticon, bothered with a hyphen to create the semblance of a nose. And since this program is called The Nose, I thought it was worth mentioning. I'll let you pick up the story, assuming you remember what he found.
I do remember. I believe that if they actually bothered to use the nose, that meant they were more conventional and sort of conservative. And younger, hipper people do not even bother with the nose.
Lazy.
Which turns out I'm super young and hip because I don't ever put the nose in. I don't know. But I was mostly just disturbed that someone was being paid to research this because who cares?
Well, you know, Rand, one of the things that was contemplated in the New Republic article was, well, maybe this is exciting in the sense that people are developing a new language or a language that harks back to cuneiform or to, you know, pictographs and pictorial languages. The writer B.J. Novak in New York Magazine a couple of weeks ago, he was asked, a whole bunch of writers and other famous people were asked what they were really looking forward to culturally this summer. And people mentioned books that were coming out and movies that were coming out. He said, oh, no, I'm the most excited about the release of 250 new emoji because you're adding such a huge percentage of an existing language. You're making a huge percentage increase to this this exciting, improvised, vivid, pictorial language. Is there any part of your curmudgeonly soul that could see it that way?
Yes, and I'll try to make this as minimally long-winded as I can. I can imagine, for instance, let's say you and your spouse or a friend, you exchange a card, a birthday card, an anniversary card, whatever. It could be witty and fun to make your message entirely out of emoticons. That would be a sort of amusing little creative moment. Actually, it would take a lot of time. You'd have to figure out how to translate it and how to do it. Since the actual daily purpose of emoticons is to simplify and speed up life, you would be using them wholly against their actual purpose. I like that idea. What interests and to some extent potentially dismays me about the use of emoticons instead of words is really not the emoticons. As long as one is playing around with them, they're fun. It's a playful thing. But you mentioned that their purpose is you can drop them into texts and tweets and posts. My problem is really not with emoticons. It's more with texts and tweets and the extent to which abbreviated forms of communication that are updated constantly have changed the way we are with each other and potentially are changing us in the same way that, you know, every technology that we make turns around and remakes us. And we have substituted frequency and speed for slowness and length. And that's a topic, you know, if you've got kids who are approaching the age when I have an 8-year-old daughter, they're going to be insisting on getting devices. You are thinking a good deal about the question of when does my child get this device, given the way these devices become part of the self, a fascinating process, a process recently ratified by none other than the Supreme Court when they said that warrantless searches of cell phones are very, very different from searching anything else you may have on your body because, in essence, the cell phone is part of your body. It is yourself. There's more stuff in there that's in your house. But anyway, for me, the topic really is about communication that consists of nearly contentless but nearly constant communicative actions.
I don't know, Rebecca, does this – I mean, first of all, you're wearing two different hats here. First, you're an authentic representative of the younger generation, but you're also a scholar of modern literature. And one thing that strikes me is, you know who would love emoji? James Joyce would have loved emoji.
Loved it.
Yeah.
He would have loved it.
He would have gone to town with them, right?
He would have written Emoji Dick before this guy.
Right,
for sure.
Exactly. But I don't know. How about Rand's criticism? Do you think your generation is doing this kind of constant title slosh of communication, which is, you know, is so terse and repetitious that it needs these little pictorial symbols just to sort of spice it up and make it palatable.
Absolutely. I have this group text with about six of my friends on my cell phone, and it really, no offense to them, I love them. It drives me crazy. I'll open up my phone and have 47 missed text messages, and I'd say maybe 90% of those are emojis. So when this topic came up, the first thing I did was ask them. I was like, what is it with these stupid symbols that you keep sending me that are driving me crazy? And the responses were amazing. They were saying things like, you can say more with them, you're accomplishing much more emotional cues. And my argument was, we're losing touch of how to articulate this with our words if we're just using a proxy instead of that. And they said, actions speak louder than words, and emojis speak louder than words, and things like that that really shocked me. And one of my friends said it was snackable content, which is something I really liked.
That's exactly what Rand is worried about, yeah. Snackable content.
And I liked it because it is kind of exactly describing what we're talking about here. You know, you pop something in your mouth, it's quick, and it's over, and that's kind of how we're moving. And I'm really worried it's going to start bleeding into real emotions and the way people interact if we're being trained and desensitized to classify a broad spectrum of emotions into 20 emojis that millions of people are using every second.
Snacks are fine, but if life is all snacks and no meal,
yeah,
it's not cheap. Healthy.
It's cheap.
So we've got a tweet here, and I'm going to give it to Teresa because I just her answer will be the funniest. Kay tweets, emojis. There are a bunch I don't understand. I can't even ask this question. There are a bunch I don't understand. What does the 18 with a red slash through it mean? I'm assuming it means the girl.
Oh, I think it's an emoji for pedophiles. Anyone over 18 is not allowed. I don't know what that means.
I see.
Do
I
it next to the dancing girl one.
Yeah, I would think that it means whoever you're talking to, or maybe the girl that you're talking to at the bar right now, in case you didn't realize that she's not 18.
Oh, like, yeah, like, but hey,
it's SOS.
It's clearly a warning. Mm-hmm. The person that you're dealing with is not 18.
Yeah.
And
wow.
That's a good – I would defend that emoji. I mean, look.
That is a good emoji.
Listen, symbols generally, we've always had recourse to them in a couple of recurring situations. One, you're driving somewhere. You're going fast. You don't have time to decode a whole sentence. You know, a symbol can help abbreviate things in a very useful way. Two, if there are multiple languages swirling around and whoever needs to direct people doesn't know what's being spoken, again, emojis are great. In the barroom situation, that gets the message across very quickly. You only have to look at it for 2 seconds. Mm-hmm. It's also funny. Mm-hmm. And so, in practical, transactional moments, great, go with emojis.
So in the words of Smokey Robinson, you'd second that emoji. All right, here's Todd in a car. I hope he's not going really fast and looking at symbols at the same time. Hi, Todd, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you? I'm not in the car anymore. I'm
okay,
home.
Good.
So.
Phew.
Yeah, and I apologize. As I'm listening, I might be off topic here. I missed the beginning of the show, but I heard a comment that made me think. One of you said that email is such a thing of the past, and I hadn't really thought about it. But then when I did, I realized it's true. You know, when I go into my email, it's either to retrieve a password or something, you know, just to see who commented on Facebook or something, but I never use it. So I'm wondering, when does texting become extinct or passe, and what's going to replace it? Are there any hints of what's next?
Well, telepathy.
Yeah. I like telepathy. That's a good one. Yeah, email died really quietly, so much so that it's actually had kind of a renaissance, right? I read something saying that email was kind of back. But you put your thumb up while he was saying that. Why did you do that?
Oh, it's just making me laugh because it's very true. And I was just reading about this new social media, Emojly, which is just communication in emojis.
Right.
Have
horrific.
A picture, and all you can do is talk using the pictures. So maybe that's where we're headed. Yeah. We're just going to start as Kion did in the beginning, and we're just going to lose all communication.
Colin,
hold up signs.
Just emoticons.
Yep.
Right. The other interesting thing about this to me is that it immediately – anything like this, anytime you sort of open up a new game preserve, all kinds of interesting jungle cats move into it. So there's been quite a debate about whether there needs to be black emoji, for example. Like the emoji are all the same color.
Except for the one in the turban. Don't forget that one.
There's the guy in the turban. But a number of social theorists have weighed in on this, including the social theorist Miley Cyrus, who agrees we need a hashtag emoji ethnicity update. That's a hashtag, emoji ethnicity update. And also there have been other it was one case in which a guy had an emoji death threat delivered at him. It was emoji of a little gun pointed at a yellow face with X'd out eyes. And the question is, would the courts recognize that as an actual
It's like a ransom note when you cut out the letters. Yeah.
So it's just, you know, it's its own ecosystem and all these things are going to be, yeah.
Did they make a decision? Did the court recognize it?
I don't think it's actually been made its way. Okay. I don't think Justice Scalia has really. I mean, okay. I can't wait for the Supreme Court to get their first emoji case because it's going to be so much fun.
Their heads will explode. They barely understand the internet.
You know, this sort of sorts out into an internationally agreed upon set of symbols. It could be sort of the new Esperanto.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, there's also – actually, I'll wait till the end to mention that. But there's an even more apt parallel than Esperanto. Not that Esperanto isn't an incredibly apt parallel. All right. Here's Jacob from West Hartford. I believe he is an unapologetic emoji user.
Yes, take it away. And unapologetic.
Take it away, Jacob. The floor is yours.
Sure. I just wanted to say I wasn't always an unapologetic user. In fact, I wasn't a user at all. But because I started out like Rand, I tuned in right as he was saying something about emojis being a symptom of this really rapid-fire, quick communication era that we live in. And that's how I looked at it too. But now I look at it more as a reconciliation of that tonal context that was capable in letters. We're just sort of beyond that now. We need something that can efficiently communicate tonal context. And that's, as a couple examples, there are some of, if you ignore a lot of the other random ones that have very specific uses, there are some subtle, like just the regular yellow smiley faces. Like, for example, there's a smiley face, but the eyebrows are curved up a little bit in a way that makes it look like a sort of at-peace smile or a I know that this is bad, but you'll get through it kind of smile. And if my girlfriend sends me something and we just live in a world where I need to be able to respond very quickly, show that it's going to be okay, but that I also understand the pain that she's going through. I can do that actually very quickly with one click.
Is there an emoji for unapologetic?
Probably. I mean, there are all sorts of eyebrow variations on different smiley faces. I bet I could find one.
And Jacob, one thing that I came to understand just reading some more about this and going to Emojipedia, which is one of the places where all of these symbols are cataloged and explained.
Of course. All the time.
I'm sure you know about Emojipedia. Well, it's clear that you and your girlfriend may have worked out your own agreement about what any particular emoji means, right? Because it seemed like as I was looking at the definitions of some of these symbols, they weren't all exactly the same. You know, the symbol could mean this, it could mean that, it could mean, you know, it could be a high five, it could be somebody praying. What were you going to say, Teresa?
One of the things I was thinking in terms of this being efficient is that there are a lot of emojis, and finding the exact right one actually seems like it would take much longer than just being like, it'll be okay, hon, you know?
That's actually true, but what it does, at least on my phone, is it takes your commonly used ones and it puts them on that front page. Okay. So I spent a lot of time in the beginning exploring the entire catalog. And if I have the time, honestly, like it's very exciting to both of us to use ones that we haven't used before, because it's like we're learning a new language. So we'll use the same ones all the time. We'll say like, good night, kissy face, things like that. And those ones are definitely in the top left of my most recently used. But it's fun to get creative and try to communicate new things. It's almost like I'll take 10 minutes to create a message that's composed of texts and pictures because I think it's just fun. But if I'm being quick, at least I have that screen.
So back to your original point to Rand, you're saying this is closer to composing a letter than it is to some default text, at least the way that you use it. You're using it that way. Rand, go ahead.
Well, this is the kind of emojification that I can happily endorse. And you know why? It's taking time. It's actually going to take him longer to create this than it would be to create its facsimile in words. I don't believe that this is what emojis are generally going to be used for. But to the extent to which they actually buck against the trend towards speed, compression, and attenuation, then, hey, I'm all for them. He's having fun. He's having fun with them.
And if you could just tweet to Teresa that it's going to be okay, hon, symbol. I mean, I think it's a good day for that. All right. So I think we have to stop. Did you have one more thing you wanted to say?
No, I'm just worried that, you know, the convenience of text speak is replacing our abilities to articulate our emotions in full sentences. And that really worries me because, you know, we're going
to
fall
away from that. I'm so glad to hear
a
young person say that.
All right. So we have to get a young person who's not a modern literature scholar. We need somebody who.
I'm sorry, I'm doing a very bad job representing my
demographic. You want us to find a stupid young person?
See, now that's the oversimplification of language that Rand is so worried about. All right, we have to take a quick break. We'll come back. We're going to talk about another digital abomination, selfies, when we get back.
Smiley with hearts for eyes, or one that's feeling blue. An alien face or a piece of poop, I'm sending them all to you. When I can't find words to say, I'll just send an emoji through space.
Okay, we're back. This is The Nose. And with us doing The Nose, Teresa Kramer, Rand Cooper, and Rebecca Castellani. And we're going to move from emoji to selfies because we want to torture Rand. So
he looks like he might actually throw himself out of the chair onto right. the floor at any
so
moment.
So we thought we were all done with the inappropriate selfie because we actually did devote a segment of The Nose months and months and months ago to selfies at funerals. I have no idea whether any of the people who are here today were there for that. But it's sort of – we thought, okay, what else is there going to be to say? Well, it turns out a lot because – This trend of doing the selfie is interrupting all kinds of things. Most recently, the Tour de France, where, in fact, people – first of all, the Tour de France needs to be said. Crowd control is really terrible anyway. I mean, there is no sporting event in which the spectators are given so many opportunities to be really disruptive and sometimes even safety threatening. But now the big problem is that they're taking selfies, and that means turning your back towards – if you want to have the bicyclists going by, you have to sort of turn your back to the action and possibly, without even meaning to, step backwards a little bit as you hold the phone at arm's length. And they're actually out on the bicycling course and colliding with bicyclists. One of the riders in the Tour de France said in the New York Times today, how many of us started out the field? 198. Well, 198 of us have had run-ins, basically, with people doing stuff like that. Piled on top of that was a New Yorker article, which we can talk a little bit more about it, an essay about the problem. Problem isn't exactly the right word. The unpleasant and questionable phenomenon of people taking selfies at sites related to the Holocaust, which is – I mean, apparently a prevalent thing, more prevalent than you might imagine. And then the one I found kind of at the last minute today from the New York Post recently, America's selfie obsession reached a new low on Tuesday when a woman snapped a cell phone self-portrait that also captured a suicidal man on the Brooklyn Bridge. With scores of onlookers watching the dramatic 10 a.m. rescue by cops – by the way, he was rescued – the camerawoman turned her back to the scene, angled her phone toward the bridge, and snapped a shot. So she got a picture of herself with the guy, the potential jumper, in the background, the scarf-clad blonde, which is the kind of phrase that only the New York Post among newspapers would use. The scarf-clad blonde even cracked a thin smile. So the selfie. I mean, I'm looking over here at you to be the centrist on all this.
Okay.
There's a place in the world for a selfie.
Yeah, I'm thinking about this, and I'm thinking, like, is the problem, like, you're taking pictures of any sort at an inappropriate time and place, like with funerals? I remember when I was a kid, my friend from across the street, her family is French-Canadian, and I don't know if this is a French-Canadian thing or what, but they used to take pictures at funerals, like, of the casket, the person in it, and I was like, what is wrong with you people? And, like, so when the whole...
They're French-Canadian.
Yeah. So when the...
they can't help themselves.
So when the funeral selfies came up, I was like, well, no one should be taking any kind of picture at a funeral. Like, these are not photo-worthy occasions. And I feel the same. I mean, would it have been any better if the woman had just taken a picture of the guy jumping off the bridge if she wasn't in it? No, you should not be sitting there, like, capturing this for posterity. And... So with the Holocaust selfies, it's sort of like, I don't know, if I went, well, Rebecca can speak better to this than I can because she's actually been in this position. But if I was actually at Auschwitz, I would probably maybe take pictures of the place and not myself. And so that, again, is sort of the problem, not the selfie.
Well, before we talk about your experience in this exact situation, and there is a difference between taking a photo of a person who's about to jump off a bridge or any kind of photo, really, and taking a selfie, right? Because, I mean, as the name suggests, the purpose of the selfie is for you to include yourself in whatever it is that's surrounding you.
Yes. And I have a personal issue with selfies sometimes because I feel like they're very vain. I feel, you know, we've really gravitated towards this self-obsessed culture where it's all about here's me in the image as opposed to just the image and letting the image speak for itself. But my experience in Auschwitz happened when I was 15, and I went with my friend's family who did not speak any English. They were very, very Polish. She spoke English, but they took me to Auschwitz. I didn't really want to go. It was I wanted to go, but I didn't really want to go. And I really didn't enjoy myself at all, as I don't think anyone enjoys themselves at Auschwitz. But they kept wanting to take pictures, like take a picture in front of the gate. And this was very minimally communicated. It was through hands and gestures. And I was very uncomfortable with this and kept refusing. And I took plenty of pictures of the actual sites. Mm-hmm. But to put myself in them, first of all, the question of what do you do with your face? You don't smile at Auschwitz. You can't like take a very serious picture because then it just looks ridiculous. So it was just a very bizarre situation to be put in, especially at 15. And to think now that people have taken that to the next level and are taking selfies at Auschwitz is just disgusting to me.
Well, of course, Rand, I believe your position is that all selfies are disgusting.
No, that's not my position.
Well, earlier today it was.
I was in a very bad mood earlier today. Now, if you know, you're your age or my age, Colin, you can remember what it was like to want to have a snapshot taken of you and a friend, you and a spouse, and you had to get someone else to take it,
mm-hmm.
and you'd give them your camera. So there's one simple way in which the selfie is making life a little bit easier in that way. Now, the quality of those pictures tends to be about what you'd expect when someone's holding the camera out, you know, like this. So it's really not about producing a quality picture. It's about chronicling your presence in the world. Now, the fact that it's so easy back with old cameras, you actually had to think, well, I got, you know, 32 shots. I don't want to waste a bunch of shots. Now you can take a million shots. It does it. You're not wasting anything. So the change in the technology has cheapened, as it were, the currency of every photographic act. And that means you can take a bazillion of these things all the time. And that has increased the ubiquity of this. Now, the specific question about their use at such places as Auschwitz, to me, raises two points. And one is, there is a natural human kind of narcissism that insists that the most important aspect of you being at any place in the world is that you are at that place. And to some extent, you know, we as human beings, we all feel that because our lives are so central to our lives. Our lives are the center of existence. The fact that this technology has combined with this sort of natural narcissism, has increased the frequency of, you know, grotesque juxtapositions and contextualizations. It's like, oh, back in the old days, you used to think at some level, yeah, the most important thing about Auschwitz today is that I'm there. But you were less able to sort of bring that narcissism to bear. There's a second issue, and that has to do with the nature of history and memorialization. The more time that goes by between where we are now and a collective hurt in the past, sort of the safer that site becomes.
So if you're doing a selfie with like a duck face or something at Pompeii,
yeah,
it's like
exactly. You know, no one's going to feel, yes, you know, that sort of that outrage because it's very old. Even Gettysburg, you know, you can pretty much do anything at Gettysburg.
Auschwitz is too soon.
You can have a birthday party at Gettysburg. You can dress up as a Union or Confederate soldier. I mean, you might not want to dance sneering on the grave of a soldier while singing Dixie, but you know, Auschwitz. We are with the Holocaust. We are at a very interesting moment, and it is the moment when very, very soon there will be no more living testimony, and we are making the transition from living human testimony, eyewitness testimony, to the more remote collective memory of history. That's an inherently vexed and difficult and interesting moment. But it's still – that means it's still relatively fresh. There are still people – we read about them every day. We know some of them. And that, again, heightens the potential grotesqueness of making – of a casually narcissistic action.
Well, let me posit a counter argument here. I mean, and not specific to concentration camp sites because I do think that's a hard argument to win. But particularly, I mean, part of the problem we should say is, and this was chronicled by, I think, an Israeli blogger who started a Facebook site, which the New Yorker said would loosely translate to with my besties in Auschwitz. And the page was – I mean, it was her attempt to really sort of call on the carpet members of her generation who were there, who were posing at these concentration camp sites for with selfies and often, you know, doing these – well, it said from the self-absorbed seriousness of some meditating on the grounds of Auschwitz-Birkenau. And that would be like the thing, like, you know, the tag that goes with the selfie, to the jarring jokiness of others hitching a ride by the train tracks. The pictures have fed a perception of today's youth as a bunch of technology-obsessed, self-indulgent narcissists. So that's sort of our central point here. But, you know, if you expand that this beyond that, I mean, that's unpalatable. But, you know, all this other stuff, you could make the argument that's kind of similar to the emoji argument, which is that this is kind of a new language, and it's a new way in which people do document where they go. And so Samuel Pepys and Virginia Woolf, they wrote diaries. You know, people have in one way or another, you know, I mean, Charles Dickens came to America and then published his journals about it. So did de Tocqueville. And I'm not saying that somebody with a selfie camera is the equivalent of de Tocqueville. I'm looking over at you because you're going to have to field this one. But this is sort of something that people do. This is sort of the technology we've embraced. This is what people do. They take pictures of themselves, and it sort of ultimately becomes, as Rand was suggesting, a record of where they've been. So maybe that's not so bad, as long as they don't crash into actual fast-moving bicycles.
Yeah, I mean, I don't mind the selfies as long as they're not abused, right? So, like, if you're taking the same selfie of yourself, like, five times in a row and then posting them all to Facebook, like, I have no time for you. Like, this is just you being vain. But if you're actually, you know, I sent out, I don't know if anyone got to read it because I sent it kind of late, but there was a defense of selfies by Simon Doonan in Slate today. And I love Simon Doonan. And he was talking about all the creative ways in which he uses selfies. Like the elfie selfie in which he like puts on something with a hood and makes himself look like an elf, and it's kind of adorable. And I, you know, you can do something well and you can do something bad, and that's the same for the selfie.
Ronald,
that's not really what Colin is asking, though.
No.
I mean, it's an interesting theme, and that is, and it's the same thing with the emojis.
Right.
Are you using it as a creative act? And you know, to me, if you are, it instantly becomes a different kind of thing. But Colin is talking about, no, just basic, like the contemporary equivalent of a journal. Now, different journals from 50 years ago would have been, one journal might have said, went to Auschwitz today, and then the next description was about, like, you know, a turkey sandwich they had at lunch and how awesome it was. Mm-hmm. Another journal might have devoted several paragraphs to describing what it was like to be at Auschwitz and evoke a sense of gravity. I wonder whether the selfie is a similarly flexible form. Maybe it is, and maybe I might well distinguish between different kinds of selfies taken there.
Mm-hmm. Although, did you have something you wanted to say?
Well, just on the nature of the selfies, the only time I've ever done them or received them is through Snapchat, which is this instant, you know, you get to see people's pictures for 30 seconds and they leave. And people have kind of used them now as journals. They have these stories now, so they can upload 6 a day, and you can click through them and see all how their day went through different postures of their face. And on the flip side of that, too, there's that anxiety that you have to record what you're doing so everybody can see it. Otherwise, did it really happen? Mm-hmm. Like, if you were at the 4th of July fireworks and you didn't take a selfie behind the fireworks, were you really there at all?
Mm-hmm.
That kind of – and I feel that with my friends all the time, the need to take pictures and document every single moment instead of just being in the moment and enjoying it. It's this kind, and I'm guilty of it too. I definitely feel the need to Instagram and tweet and do all that stuff. But I wonder, I don't think anyone actually writes journals anymore. They're too busy updating their Snapchat stories.
Well, I'll end this discussion on a declinist note, sort of, which is that I think the original thing that Rand said is really true, which is that from the time cameras became available to the average person, there's been sort of a basic trend where, first of all, everybody goes to the Grand Canyon and takes a picture, although there really are plenty of pictures of the Grand Canyon. There's no real reason to take another one. It seems unlikely that you will get an especially good one of the Grand Canyon or the Eiffel Tower or anything else. And that the other thing that people do, obviously, is they get pictures of themselves taken. Either they take pictures of their mate or they hand their camera to somebody else to get those two pictures. And that's fine. I mean, that's a natural human impulse. I did have this experience last year where for 2 weeks I was traveling in Europe for a magazine article. And traveling with me was the photographer Steve Lashever. And Steve is like a really great photographer who actually did take an amazing photo at the Eiffel Tower that was like completely different from anything that I've ever seen. But what I was really made aware of, partly because some of the time he's driving me crazy wanting to stop the tandem bike we were on, you know, every 300 feet because he'd see something else and he wanted want to take a picture of it, is how incredible his eye was. You know, when I saw the pictures all at the end that he had taken, I thought, you know, I don't really know how to look at anything, do I? I mean, I just walk around thinking about where I'm going to have lunch, you know, and stuff like that. But I'm not really looking. And when I saw the way that he had been looking, even though he'd been driving me crazy with all these pictures, I realized, wow, that's like a whole different thing. And if I were worried about one thing about selfies, it's an even greater invitation to think only about yourself standing on the bridge of sighs or something and not really how everything looks around you. And as I say, it was really like a bucket of water thrown in my face when I saw the pictures that he took. I thought, my God, I was in all of those places and I just didn't see any of that. So that's just another thing we might atrophy. Hey, really quickly, and we won't have too much – do I even dare bring this up? Yeah, we'll just do it really fast. So the last thing we wanted to talk about was a guy on Facebook. His name is Zach Danger Brown. I believe the danger is an affectation. He launched a campaign on Kickstarter, the crowdfunding website to raise money to make a bowl of potato salad. He offered no business plan or proof of the concept. I'm reading from the New Yorker piece about him. He didn't claim his potato salad would be the next cupcake or anything like that. He just said, basically, I'm just making potato salad, and I haven't decided what kind yet. At the moment, I think he's got $46,000 in pledged money. It's turned into various kinds of controversy, including stuff about issues about what he really should do with this money, since he doesn't really need $46,000 to make a bowl of potato salad. So I'll go around the table, everybody, just so you can give me your quick. You got something ready?
It's his money. He gets to keep it. He can buy $46,000 worth of potato salad, or he can go get a new car. They gave it to him. They knew how much he'd already accumulated.
All right. Some of them took it away, right? He was up to like 70 at one point.
Did he?
And, yeah, and then some of the pledges went down. Maybe some
they were like, no, that's too much. We gotta
46
take this
is enough. 76,000. Too much.
You don't need $70,000. You just need 46,000 for your potato salad. What does this say to you, Rand?
This is a phenomenon that just begs for explanation, and there are different competing hypotheses. At first, I thought, well, maybe it's just an accident, and people thought that he was doing something fabulous, and so they said, oh, that's $10. Maybe it's a kind of systemic irony or horse laugh or sense of humor that one gives $5 to this because there are so many other much more serious, demanding sounding things. So it's sort of this collective having a kind of collective horse laugh. Or maybe it's just like, I think of this internet as like this huge brain, and this is just some sort of synaptic misfiring. it has to happen in order for the brain to do all the productive things that it does. They're just like random firings and various energies, and this is it. This is a systemic random synapse firing away.
All right, Rebecca, that's a tough act to follow.
It is a tough act to follow. I think he needs to commit to it and make $46,000 worth of potato salad.
Maybe you should just open a potato salad restaurant.
Yeah. That would be great. Yeah. Huge mountain of it's $46,000.
You made your bed now, lie in it.
It could be at least a tourist attraction, and people would take selfies of them, you know,
yeah,
standing
exactly
in front of the biggest potato salad.
I would go visit that.
I would too.
But would you take a selfie?
Oh, yes.
And what kind of emoji would you send to Rand?
Probably the
smiling turd, definitely.
I guess I kind of asked for that, didn't I? All right, so we'll stop there. How could we possibly stop anywhere else? We'll take a break. We'll come back with endorsements.
Solid potato salad. That's solid salad. Jack, hit your mama with the solid potato salad, boy. Take my plate, fill it up, and bring it right back. Solid potato.
The selfie. Probably the only thing the Pope and Anthony Weiner have in common. Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me. Our interns are Josh Nalea and Lily Tyson. Greg Hill appeared in the intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. Katie Tolarski is our executive producer. The part of Bill Curry was played by James Franco. For show pages, articles, and bathroom mirror selfies of the Faith Middleton Show staff, visit our website, WNPR.org. On Monday, Anna Sale, host of the podcast Death, Sex, and Money, joins The Scramble as our super guest. And now, back to Colin.
Greg Hill just came in here and took a selfie. And speaking of Greg Hill, one thing I forgot to bring up when we were talking about emojis, Greg Hill made a great link between that and George Orwell's Newspeak in 1984, where Newspeak is really described as an effort to make smaller and smaller dictionaries so that ultimately speech will become as staccato and simple as possible. And a word like free will only have one meaning, right? It can only mean sort of, you know, hair-free something or other, as opposed to actually being freedom. Anyway, so think about it anyway. We didn't have enough time to develop that point. So this is The Nose with us from The Cut, a magazine celebrating the follies of Connecticut. It is Teresa Kramer. Later today, she will put on a bathing suit and leap 20 feet into a 700-gallon drum of calamine lotion. Won't you support the cure? Look, you'll pay for potato salad. At least give us a dollar for that. Writer Rand Cooper and modern literature scholar Rebecca Castellani also with us. Time for endorsements. We only have 5 minutes, but I bet we can do them. Rebecca, what are you going to be endorsing?
I got two endorsements, both occurring in my favorite little town, which is Collinsville. The first is there's a brand new art gallery opening tonight at 6. It's the Underground Gallery. It looks like it's going to be really great. And the other is a tried and true favorite, Bridge Street Live. They do live music, comedy, and it's right on the Farmington River. It's beautiful. Great food, great drinks. Definitely a place to spend your Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Thursday, whatever day.
All right. And cards on the table. You may occasionally see Rebecca Costello.
Maybe.
There. Maybe. All right. So, Rand, what are you endorsing?
I'm going to endorse a series of 4 novels by the British writer Edward St. Aubyn. And they're all short novels, and they're contained in one volume that I have here in front of me. They're called the Patrick Melrose novels because that's the name of the main character. Edward St. Aubyn is one of these writers that I'd vaguely heard of, and then I kept reading profile after profile of the guy, a long piece in The New Yorker a few issues back. And these novels, or this one work, are in part a wickedly entertaining satire of the British ruling classes. But it's a strange hodgepodge of a novel because at the same time it's also a very detailed and in places lyrical evocation of early childhood. And finally, it's a pretty scary book about family dysfunction at the same time. So these seem like almost unmixable qualities. The last thing I'll say about him is that if you're the kind of reader who enjoys a spectacular prose stylist, as opposed to the kind of reader who sort of wants the story told straight, I would very much, if you want the story told straight, don't go here. But if you appreciate a high style in prose that is wickedly ironic at the same time, then go to Edward St. Aubyn. That's St. Aubyn, the Patrick Melrose novels.
All right. Teresa Kramer.
I will start with the Hartford Movies After Dark on Friday nights. You can see free movies in a variety of parks. I saw Jaws a few weeks ago. Tonight you can see Whippet in Bushnell Park. I won't be there because I would scare the children, and so I'm not allowed to go. But also an app I've been using called Woof Tracks. It uses the GPS on your phone to follow your walk with your dog, and it then also donates money to the shelter of your choice based on how far you walk.
Woof Track.
Woof Tracks with an X.
Tracks with an X, of course. Okay, a few quick things to endorse. First of all, since Rand is mentioning extraordinary prose stylist, I think he would agree with me that Adam Gopnik is one of the ones that we have today. I really recommend his piece in the current issue of The New Yorker. You can't read it in entirety online because it's locked, so you have to have a subscription or whatever. But if you can get it, his piece, it's kind of a takedown of the restoration of the 9/11 site in New York, but it's just brilliantly argued and just lapidary prose and really, really fascinating observations. He's just so great. And then the emoji thing got me thinking about a man named Charles Bliss, who did try to develop kind of a simplistic pictorial version of Esperanto. And there have been a number of interesting pieces about him, but I'm going to recommend the one that was done by Radiolab. If you look online, you can find I think it's called The Man Who Became Bliss or something like that. Anyway, radiolab.org. If you just type Charles Bliss into Google, it's one of the first things that you'll get. And it's sort of a story of thwarted utopian frustrations, as I remember it. Lastly, on July 21st, the Institute Library in New Haven, just a place we love, and we've done a show from there, and it looks like Henry Ward Beecher just spoke there yesterday. It just is this great antique, beautiful place. Anyway, they're doing a fundraiser on July 21st, and it allows you to go to different restaurants and have dinner with various authors, and then you come back to the Institute Library, and there's music at the end. Go to theinstitutelibrary.org, institutelibrary.org, and then click on events. You can find out more about it. I'm going to go down there and have dinner at Nini's, which I know Rand thinks is a great restaurant, with my friend Brian Francis Slattery, who will be the author there. But there are all kinds of different authors, including Marianne Tyrone Smith, who was just on with us the other day. A great thing. Thank you so much to Teresa Kramer and Rebecca Castellani and Rand Cooper. We'll be back on Monday with The Scramble.
Vernon, I already said that one. Avon, Farmington. Yeah, 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 yeah. I'm on the radio.
I'm Kyone Wolf. When it comes to selfies, I try to keep it at arm's length.
Oh, no.
Oh, come on. It's Friday, you guys. Give me a break. Oh.